Our main speaker tonight is Vincent S.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Vincent. I'm an alcoholic. And it really is an honor to be here, to be asked back. I spoke here last year. I think it was in July. And I was shocked that I was asked to come back and speak. It was just such an honor the first time. And you know, I want to say before, my sober date is March 2nd, 1997, and I'm sober 11 years this year. And I have a service commitment at a prison in Staten Island. I also have a rehab commitment in Jersey. I moved to Jersey a couple of years ago from Manhattan, but I'm a lifelong Manhattan resident. And I have a sponsee that has 19 days today. And I was with him today at lunchtime. He had a half a day. And for some reason, I had some downtime on the job, and I had him come to my job and hung out with him. And honestly, I hang my hat on that today, that I'm 11 years sober, and I got a guy with 19 days that I'm getting ready to do some work on, you know? And I have two of my sponsees here also. I'll probably forget to share about this. That's why I want to mention it now, because it's kind of important to me. My sponsee Andrew is here, that I met on the Upper West Side of Manhattan when I went to Smithers Rehab on a commitment. I picked him up there, and he baptized my daughter. He's my daughter's godfather. And my sponsee Phillip's here, and he's getting married Saturday. He met a nice girl in a program, just like I did. I met my wife in AA, and I'm his best man. And my little two-year-old daughter is the ring bearer. I mean, the flower girl. My 14-year-old son is the ring bearer. And I'm having a wonderful life, man. I didn't have a great family life. I'm going to segue right into my qualification. I didn't have a great family life, something I also don't share about in AA meetings, because I heard for years, you know, I came to meetings for a lot of years before I did actually get sober, that it's a family disease, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'm from an alcoholic family. I'm from an alcoholic neighborhood. I'm from an alcoholic city, you know, and, yeah. I could qualify just on my neighborhood, you know, and my family. But not to make light of it, I buried two brothers and a sister from this disease. They didn't make it to 30 years old. And I turned 50 this year, you know, and I got to say it again, man, I really am having a wonderful life. And when I was a kid, my mother and my aunt had six kids respectively. And one Friday night, they took a break from motherhood and were out bar hopping in the city. And they crashed. And my mother's never been the same. She's an alcoholic. And she killed her sister that night in the front seat of the car. And that's the kind of family I grew up in. You know, a lot of tragedy, a lot of death, a lot of heavy paid prices for drinking, period, you know. I had a couple other relatives that passed due to alcohol and drugs, but I'm just going to go into to me that at 11 years old, the first time I picked up a drink. I was early to school because my birthday is in November, so I got pushed into actually junior high school, 7th grade, at 11 years old. And I showed up the third day of school to get my program card, and I was drunk. I had been drinking on a handball court. And as is customary with me, I got disruptive at 11 years old, drunk in school. And I had a fight with a teacher. And I was expelled. And I wound up in family court in front of a judge. And, you know, it seemed like in the blink of an eye, you know, I was 39 years old. I was on my way back to prison for drinking and drugging. I had served almost 15 years of my life from when I was a little kid up until when I was a 39-year-old guy being processed back into the system, and had been in and out of AA, been married and divorced. And at this time, when I was 39 and I was coming back in 1996, I had already done two state prison sentences, and I had my second wife, who was active, and I had a 15-month-old baby boy, my son that's still with me now, my 14-year-old. And I was being processed back in, and this guy who He's just an angel, man. That's all I could say about it. I didn't feel that way at the time, but he was processing me in, much like you're oriented into college or into the military or whatever. They were reviewing my record, and he was sitting there looking at me, and he was thumbing through the pages, and I was uncomfortable. And he said, "Man, Vincent," he said, "your record goes back to 1974. He said, "Man, it's 1996. Do you know that? This is 1996, and here you are again." And that's 3 decades. That sounded like 30 years to me for some reason. I'm not that good at math, but he said 3 decades, and I was like, "Man, that's 30 years. He said, "You know, you entered into the state prison system in 1979. We gave you this number in 1979. Then you came back and got another number in 1987. And now you're back and it's 1996. He said, "Man, your way is not working." And he just, you know, if I wasn't sitting down already, I would have sat down at that point. And I was all ears. You know, this guy had me, and I had never laid eyes on him before. All he had in front of him was my record, and that record was the only thing on this planet that said who I was. I never had a driver's license. I never had utility bills under my name. I never paid taxes. I never had a job on the books. I never traveled. I never booked a room. I never rented a car. That was it, man. This is who I was at 39 years old. And this guy basically, in a sentence, called me on that, and I didn't have an answer for him. And he said, "Well, you know, there's something definitely going on with you, man. I don't have a lot of... I never got a DWI, you know. Don't laugh, but, you know, I got away a lot because I didn't have a driver's license, so it was hard to pull me over and give me a drunk test if you didn't catch me. And I didn't lose a job because my boss was banging on the desk, and you know why. I wasn't never employed like that, you know. So what this guy had on me was what they had on me, and what I represented was some guy that just lived off the grid his entire life. I drank, and I lived, and I existed, and I did the next whatever thing that I had to do. And this guy made a suggestion to me that... So he was looking at my record, and he said, and he didn't see drugs or alcohol or drug arrests or DWIs, like I was saying, but he took a shot and made a suggestion that they have these facilities now where they offer treatment. And I knew what treatment was. You know, I didn't resist. He said, I can rubber stamp you and you can go back up to Auburn or Clinton or Comstock or Sing Sing and hang out with your fellas and your families and make macaroni and drink back black coffee and tell stories and come out in a few years and try it again. Or he says, you could try something different. You can sign into one of these programs where it's 12-step based, and you're going to be in basically a treatment center run by the Department of Corrections. He says you have nothing to lose. And he got me to sign with that. And I signed up for this program in prison. And I did the best I could with what I had. I wasn't used to surrendering in any form. But I would, yeah. I didn't make almost 15 years in a penitentiary by surrendering to anyone. I actually did it by resisting and stuff like that. Those were qualities that I admired at the time. But I was in a position at 39 years old with a little bit of season, maybe maturity under my belt, whatever limited experience I had with that at that time, that, you know, I was a little open and receptive to, like, because this guy said, you know, this is something different. This might be a little different for you. So I acted as if in this program, and I existed, and I flew under the radar, and I acted like a model prisoner. And it didn't last long. Even in there, after 9 months, I relapsed. And I didn't say anything. And then I didn't want to get thrown out of the prison, right? I didn't want to, you know, they wasn't going to send me home. They was going to send me another behind a wall somewhere. So I kept my mouth shut like a good alcoholic. And that didn't last long either. You know, that doesn't work, you know, if you knew. And it doesn't work. You know, soon after that, around March 1st, I picked up again in there. And this time, everything that I had heard in meetings. I've been in and out of AA for a long time before. I went to my first meeting in 1989. And all the stuff that I heard, that I rolled my eyes out and shrugged my shoulders, that it stops working, it's miserable existence. All that happened to me in one night. You know, everybody else that picked up that day was bouncing off the walls, and I was sitting on my bed watching it get light out, and I was miserable, twisted, hopeless, and empty inside. I wasn't feeling the way I was supposed to be feeling, and I just got twisted and angry and resentful, and something happened to me. My first response was that when they came around and told me to stand for the count, I refused. You know that? I don't care anymore. Give you the finger and do whatever you got to do. That applies across the board, no matter where you are. I'm saying this as my experience as an alcoholic. So I just refused everything that day. I refused to get up for the count. I refused to make my bed or put on my uniform or go to work or march or go to chow. By the end of the day, they put me in a hole. They packed my stuff. They put me in a hole. And I knew this was going to happen. It was just going to... I was done. I was like, you know what? Man, nothing's working. AA program, prison, whatever I'm using. It's just pointless. So I figured they just scoop me up and get me out. And they did. They threw me in a hole. But a funny thing happened. And while I was trying to do the right thing, and I was going to meetings, you know, someone like myself and like a lot of us brought a meeting into a facility. In this particular case, there was a guy named Tony that would always tell me, you know, you're beyond God, you're beyond human help. You need God's help. You know, you're a know-it-all. You know, you're one of them guys from the city that, you know, you talk a good game. And he would try to encourage me like that. But anyway, yeah, he sent me the big book. He got an officer to bring the big book to my cell in the hall. I don't know if he ever thought he'd see me again, you know. And he sent me the big book. This cop knocked on my door and put the big book through the bean hole there where my food tray usually goes. And I opened up the cover of the big book, and on the cover where we usually write to our sponsees on that blank page, well, this guy wrote and said, you know everything there is to know about AA, Vincent, but you need to... You need to read this book again, and you need to ask God to help you. And, I had never done that before. And I've been in a lot of tight spots in the years of my drinking and in and out of different facilities, penitentiaries, and institutions of all different kinds. And I was pretty comfortable in a way at the time, you know, like environmentally. You know, I had a place to stay. The water was running. The lights were on, you know. And I wound up on my knees in my cell after I read that from this guy. And all I could come up with was, you know, God help me. Help me, please, man, please. I remember looking at myself in the mirror because I was trying to shake it off. And I wet my face in the sink and I came out. You know, I stood up and I was looking at myself in the mirror. And I just looked in my eyes for the first time in such a long time. And I just saw myself for who I was in a brief moment, man. You know, I was 39. I was back in the penitentiary again. You know, my son was never going to have a father. I was never going to have a life. And it was never going to be any different. It was never going to be any different. There was nothing anybody could tell me that would make me, at 39 years old, think that my life was suddenly going to change for the better. It's always been like this. In one form or another, it was always just like this. And I convinced myself, thank God, at that moment, that it was never going to be any different. So I wound up on my knees in this cell, crying my eyes out, asking God to help me. Please help me. And, sometime later, I did open the big book, and I started reading. And there's basically three things that really, really caught my attention about first starting to read the big book with the earnestness of a guy looking for something better. And it was, the first thing was the forward to the first edition that says, we're 100 men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous who have recovered. And I had read that book many times. And I had heard that when you're ready, it's going to start to sound different. And immediately it did, right at the forward. I said, man, these people have recovered from this, you know? And They drank like I did. I read all the stories a lot. I didn't do a lot. I didn't concentrate a lot on the first 164 pages a while back, but I did now, and I started from the beginning. Another thing that turned me on was, rarely have we seen a person fail that thoroughly followed our path. I've been a failure my whole life. My whole life was just a failure. And I was warmed up to that. And another thing that... The other thing I probably can't remember right now, I'll tell you the truth, but there's something else that I hear often that, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we're going to see how our experience can help someone else. And for some reason, even with a couple of days of reading a big book in the box, in the hole, in prison, I saw hope in that. I said, wow, man, my life might not be a waste if I could help someone. Because I've been to 100 meetings, and I heard people share the experience, strength, and hope. And I could do that. I'd shared before and stuff like that. And I started to get hopeful. And I'll tell you, 28 days later, when I was supposed to get shipped out of that facility, I didn't get shipped out. They gave me a clean slate. And I have no idea why they did that. That is not, there's nothing in my record that calls for that. Nothing. Nothing. There is nothing in my record that says, give him another shot. It's Vinny. Give him another shot. Look at him. He's so cute. Give him another shot. There was nothing in there. Just to hop around a little bit, I went on trial one time in 1986. I got acquitted, but I still had to do a couple of years. A couple of years to me is 4 or 5 years. Because I was in violation of my parole, just for getting mixed up in the shenanigans, you know. So what I do, I had trailer visits, so I got married in the Tombs in Lower Manhattan, 125 White Street, the men's house of detention. I was dating a girl briefly, and somehow she came to visit me. She heard I was in prison, and I got married. And a couple of years later, I got out. It didn't work out anyway. She was, yeah. Yeah, this is just some of the stuff that happened to me that doesn't make any sense. And, like, I'm telling you, this is 10 years after that, and I'm thinking, like, why the hell would anybody give me a break? You know, she was a Barnard girl from Columbia, and she became an attorney and was waiting for me like we were going to have a life when I got out. And I went back to doing what I was doing, so, of course, it didn't work out. She brought me to my first meeting. I made a seven-step amend. I made a nine-step amends to her a few years later in this program. I heard in a meeting, if you could remember the first person that took you to AA, get in touch with them and thank them. You know, she picked up the phone, and I hadn't spoken to her in a lot of years. We were married in 1987, and this was 1998. I had a couple of years sober, and I said, Lisa, and she said, what do you want? And it was 10 years later. She said, what do you want? I said, what do you mean, what do you want? She said, when I hear from you, it's not good. It didn't stop me from making an amends to her and for actually putting a lot of stuff behind us, you know. And I married my son's mother right after some. I left the girl at the altar 6 days before the wedding. I relapsed. I was in for a minute in the program. And I left her at the altar, and I wound up marrying my son's mother, a girl from my neighborhood, and that didn't work out. And when I went back to prison, when he was a 15-month-old baby, it got worse and worse for them out there, and there was nothing I could do about it. But when I got out of the hole in prison and I went back to my block and back to my job and back to my cell and back to my group and back to my counselor and back to this guy Tony in those meetings, they all just looked at me and said, these are people in AA, mind you. They said, man, there's something different about you. So in those 28 days in the hole by myself, I had worked the first couple of steps to the best of my ability. I added a big book. And I asked this guy to help me to get through the steps, to start, you know, start the steps. And he brought me in these tapes. And you know what tapes I'm talking about. And I started to go through the steps. And 13 months sober, and up to the seventh step, I got released. And it was like, I started all over again. I'd gotten off the bus at Port Authority many times in my life coming back from places. I wasn't mildly afflicted. Let me put it like that. I was 40 years old. I got off the bus at Port Authority many times, and it was never any different. The difference was the day I got out, I called my sponsor like he asked me to from Port Authority before I went for a walk. And he gave me some directions. Go to the nearest meeting, and I went to Al-Anon House. I made two more meetings that night. 2 days later, me and him sat down, and he said, look, this is what I'm doing. I do service, I have sponsees, and I have a job. I think I could get you on with me. And this was 2 days after I got out of prison. I'm still there. It's 10.5 years later. I'm still on that job. I started as a hired hand. I got in a union after about a year, a labor union, just knuckling up, man, taking care of my son. I took my son off his mother because it was the right thing to do, you know, and it was hard. If anybody here, a lot of people counting days here, you know, it's a struggle. And I was told not to enjoy the struggle, but to thank God that you are struggling, because the alternative is, you know, we surrender to the disease. That's what I was told. So I struggled. I slept at people's houses with my son. I made meetings. I showed up for work. And I just kept at it and kept at it and kept. I did service right away. I showed up at the Salvation Army just to show up to a meeting. They asked me to speak because I had more than 90 days. And I wound up with a commitment there. That was my first commitment. I've always had a commitment. I've always had a sponsor. I've always come to meetings. I was in a meeting last night, and I was in a meeting the day before. And I started getting promoted in my company. I became a laborer, a union laborer. A couple of years later, I started training on equipment, and my life got so much better. Just not drinking and coming to meetings and doing service a day at a time. I left my old neighborhood. I finally found a place to stay. It took a couple of, almost 2 years to get the opportunity to sign a lease under my name. I had no credit history. I had no driver's license. I had no photo ID. I was getting a paycheck long before I could deposit them in the bank. I asked people to cash my check. I asked people if me and my son could stay at their house. Stuff like that. You know, you just do it. You just do it. I put my hand up in meetings and said, you know, this is what's going on with me. And people came out of the woodwork to help me. And I met my wife on the Upper West Side of Manhattan a few years ago. And my son has a mother now. And we started a life together right on the Upper West Side. My wife, my son, and me. And a few years into it, we got married. And we had a nice wedding at the 79th Street Boat Basin. And we started to develop a life together. And then we decided that we would buy a house. And we bought a home in Jersey. And this is not about the cash and prizes, but for a guy that did not exist financially, civilly, humanly, you know, I have a swimming pool and a 3-car garage. My father lives downstairs. Yeah. From a life of looking for parking spots in Manhattan, I got a 100-foot driveway with a 3-car garage, a half basketball court in my backyard. My son has the whole top of the house. Our first apartment was a 3-floor walk-up on 75th Street with a bathroom down the hall. And my son was only 6 or 7 when we got that apartment, and we walked in together. I had 6 garbage bags. I was sober a couple of years. It was always a struggle for me, always a struggle. I was not mildly afflicted. And when we walked in that apartment, he said, Dad, this is it? He said, this is it? I said, yeah, man, this is it. This is home. And we planted our flag on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. We had lived previously where I was used to living, in Lower Manhattan and Little Italy. And there was a time when my sponsor said, you know, you could live wherever you want, right? You know that, right? Like, you can just get the newspaper and look for an apartment. You know, you got a job. You know, no, for a while, though, I was convinced that, you know, I was stuck in this existence, because any time I left a deposit for an apartment, I would be all excited and come back to get the key. They'd give me my money back. I had no credit history. I had no work history. I had no, you know, it was only, everything was new. Everything was a struggle. My driver's license was a nightmare. I would walk in there and like a newcomer, I would convict myself before they even type my name in. I would say, yeah, I'm trying to get a license. You know, I got banged up on a million tickets and the flags would go up. I wondered why they just almost kind of threw me out, you know. I was actually sitting for a crane license in New York City, a difficult license to get, let me tell you. A New York City crane license because of the structure of Manhattan and the pedestrians and the buildings and the codes. It's a difficult license to get. I was sitting for a crane license exam, and somebody told me that it'd be a good idea to get a driver's license right about now. And I was like, yeah, okay. I had a photo ID. It was good enough for me. I could open a bank account, I could cash my checks. You know, it was always good enough. And a woman told me early on in AA that you will limit your sobriety. Be careful. Only you can limit this. This is limitless. So I started to take the limitations off myself. I started to look at other people in the program and in life and say, if he can do it, I can do it. That guy did it. I could do it. So I own a home. I got a nice truck. My wife's got a leased vehicle. My wife is on Martha's Vineyard this week with my 2-year-old daughter. We have a wonderful life. I turned 50 this year. I had a midlife crisis. I bought an expensive gift for myself to celebrate turning 50 and 10 years of continuous employment, which I didn't go overboard. I just bought myself a nice watch. And I got my wife pregnant. So that's my midlife crisis. I'm 50. My wife is pregnant. And we're picking out names. And my daughter's leaving me messages on my phone. I'll kiss you later, Daddy. And my 14-year-old son is torturing me because that's his job as a 14-year-old boy. Yeah, he's doing exactly what he's supposed to do. But he isn't doing what I was doing. He's not doing. He hasn't been to juvenile hall. Or escaped. I had escaped from juvenile hall from Spofford in the Bronx by his age. You know, I was getting arrested. I was getting in trouble. I was being looked for. No one could find me. It's not like that. My son comes home. He's got a wonderful home. He's got a beautiful life. He's got a real good dad. I'm a little too lenient, you know. But I'm sober, and I'm having a wonderful life. And I didn't just change. This program didn't just change me a little bit. If it was up to me, I would have let it change me a little bit. I would have been satisfied with staying, you know, a block from Central Park, probably for the rest of my life, which is not a bad deal, you know, but so much more happened to me. We all have passports. I leave the country every year for the last 8 years on vacation. I take my family through international customs, you know. You know, that's, if you're a parent, you know, you've rented a house down the shore for a week, you know what that's like. Well, leaving the country is different, and it's wonderful. And I go down there to Costa Rica every year, and I spend a week or two with a guy that owns a place that's in the program from New York, and he treats me like I'm family, and we bring my sponsees down, and my sponsor comes down, and a bunch of people from New York. Over the years, it just got bigger and bigger. Like, stuff like that, I could have never planned. Where we at there, brother? Okay. And I really am having a wonderful life, and if I didn't surrender to this program and the suggestions and listen to my sponsor, I didn't always do what he said, but I did listen. A lot of what he said to me came to fruition years later, and I said, wow, I know why he said that to me. You know, I share that same stuff with my sponsees, and I'm just having a wonderful life, man. And it really is. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.